I'm Brandi Cruz. Coming up today on Undivided, more bureaucracy is not the way to solve what ails Seattle. Plus, we're joined by a King County senior deputy prosecuting attorney who's working on preventing juvenile crime. And is it an insult to call Kamala Harris a DEI hire? The Seattle Times thinks so. That and more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, you can support our show for just $5 a month by signing up at undividedpod.com. Hello and welcome to Undivided. I'm Brandi Cruz. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. Missed you guys over the weekend. As you know, we never have a show on Fridays, but that doesn't mean we weren't fighting for you on Friday. Of course we were. So on Friday, the public records lawsuit that Undivided has against the city of Seattle was in court for final arguments. I was there in court with our fantastic attorney, Jackson Maynard, from the Citizen Action Defense Fund. We were perhaps expecting a final decision on the case from the judge, but she opted not to rule from the bench, which she's totally in her rights to do. And so we're expecting to find out in a matter of days whether the King County judge in this case will side with us in our public records lawsuit against the city of Seattle. So stay tuned. But as I said, after the court hearing on Friday, you know, preserving the spirit of the Public Records Act is paramount. It is under attack more than it has ever been since voters passed it in the 1970s, with the expectation and the hope that it would make it so that our government was more transparent. And I think quite the contrary in terms of our government being transparent all these decades later. You know, it really feels like the PRA is under attack. You've had lawmakers, frankly, from both sides of the political aisle who tried to exempt themselves from the Public Records Act. Republicans rightfully wised up and stopped trying to do that. But we still see these efforts from Democratic lawmakers to exempt themselves. We see various public entities across the state, not just at the state level, but at the city level and county level, who take months, if not years, to respond to reasonable public records requests. You guys will know I haven't talked a lot on the show about our lawsuit against the city of Seattle, and that's because I respect the process that it needs to go through. And I don't think that getting on this show and ranting and raving about the case and the ins and outs of it is productive. And I want the judge to decide the case on its merits. Just a little bit of background on our public records lawsuit against Seattle. You might recall that last summer, there was a very consequential vote in Seattle on whether to recriminalize, in so many words, the use of drugs publicly. We saw, you know, this proliferation of drug use out in the open in downtown Seattle, in the core of the city, in the tourist areas, in the business areas. There had been all this dysfunction at the state level about whether to de facto legalize hard drugs. So the city of Seattle puts this thing up to a vote to finally give police the tool they need to be able to go out and arrest people who are smoking drugs out in public. And Andrew Lewis, you'll recall, then Councilman Andrew Lewis, shocked everyone in the final minutes and voted no, when he told everyone else behind the scenes, in front of cameras, that he was a yes vote. And then he said, I'm not going to do it. So you might recall that that was suspicious to us. It was odd to us. And so we had filed a very narrow public records request for his emails and his phone calls and his text messages from about a 10-hour period of time that day to try to figure out whether anyone influenced him to switch his vote at the last minute. We filed that records request. I expected reasonably to get it back in about a month, considering how narrow it was. Instead, the city of Seattle told us we'd get our first installment just days after the primary election that Andrew Lewis was on the ballot for, and we'd get our second installment just days after the general election that Andrew Lewis was on the ballot for. So that just, having filed more than 500 public records requests in my career, that just didn't smell right. So the Citizen Action Defense Fund filed suit on our behalf, and that case has been working its way through the system. So we should know in a matter of days whether we are going to win our public records lawsuit against the city of Seattle. So we'll keep you up to date on that. However, just being in court and, you know, talking about this case reminded me of the whole reason why we're here to begin with, and that is, of course, the rampant drug use in downtown Seattle, right? A couple months after Andrew Lewis tanked that vote to recriminalize public drug use, they came to a kind of a consensus and a compromise, and they ended up pushing through a different ordinance. It was a little watered down, but they did say, we want police to be able to go after and arrest people who are using illegal drugs downtown. And when you think about that a year ago and you ask yourself, well, they passed that, but have things gotten any better? If you've been downtown lately, Nicole was downtown with some friends that were in town, and you were saying that, like, and I've been downtown too. It doesn't look any better to me. It's certainly, no. And for you, you guys saw Fetty Lean's.
I mean, it was less than a block from the parade happening.
Right.
And there was a guy doing the Fetty Fold. And I mean, it was disturbing. There was quite a few. There was one guy smoking crack right by the sidewalk, right by the parade.
Yeah.
And nobody was doing anything. And I mean, I know they can't really. I mean, they get out if they do, and it's not worth it.
That's the issue, is they can, but are they? Mm-hmm. And is there a breakdown in the system? Because it's one thing to pass an ordinance saying, yes, police can arrest people who are smoking crack or, you know, shooting up fentanyl, but are they able to do it in a way that makes sense, right? And that has been the question. It's one thing to use our limited resources to have officers go down and arrest people, but if they just get kicked out, you know, if they're not booked in jail, if they're not prosecuted, then what's the point? Then you've taken an SPD officer off the street for 3 hours to essentially do nothing to help the problem at all. In fact, there is that clip we played the other day from a Cairo 7 story where they were down there broadcasting live, police arrest a guy for public drug use, and then like 3 hours later, while they're still down there broadcasting live, they see this same guy who was already out of jail, wasn't even booked in, who's again smoking fentanyl.
So you see, even had time to sober up, right, there.
Like, so you see, it doesn't even really make sense. So anyway, I was thinking about this on Friday because our public records lawsuit was about the drug ordinance, and then the Seattle Times editorial board puts out a headline that really echoes that feeling. Public drug use is illegal in Seattle. You'd never know it. That the headline from the Seattle Times editorial board, it said, wasn't it supposed to get better? It's been nearly a year since Seattle City Hall agonizingly passed an ordinance making open drug consumption a misdemeanor. And the blocks around 3rd Avenue and Pike Street are just as terrible as they've always been, perhaps even worse. So once in a while, the Seattle Times ed board and I are in agreement, although it's very hard for me to take them seriously when you have the Seattle Times ed board coming out with this op-ed complaining about how bad the drug crisis is, when just like 2 weeks ago, they endorsed Bob Ferguson for governor and he is in favor of decriminalizing hard drugs. So the Seattle Times ed board is totally spastic. They're all over the place. Like, oh, hard drugs bad. Downtown Seattle looks like crap, but let's endorse the guy for governor who would make all of this much, much worse. So yeah, that doesn't make any sense. All of that aside, I see it. Nicole saw it. Her out-of-town guests saw it. The Seattle Times editorial board saw it. The drug crisis is still horrible in downtown Seattle. And that's because you can pass an ordinance, but if it's not working in practice, like the policy is there, but in practice, there's clearly still a huge breakdown. And there's a variety of factors from that, from low police staffing. They've got shootings and gang issues and all these things to respond to. So yeah, I'm sorry, their resources probably are not going to be able to be best utilized arresting people who are smoking fentanyl downtown. But then you have all the other breakdowns, the breakdown in jail bookings, the breakdown, you know, at the in court when cases do and if they do go to court. And then you have the complete and utter breakdown in services. Like, don't we spend hundreds of millions of dollars to try to get people who are addicted help? Like, do we not do that? Hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars to help people who are addicted to drugs. So shouldn't we be seeing better results in this holistic approach they talked about? So something mentioned by the Seattle Times, and I want to go through it here in detail. The Seattle Auditor's Office earlier this month, they released a 65-page report. 65-page reports are just my favorite, on why things are still so bad. Like, what's the breakdown here? So I appreciate the auditors, the title of the report, addressing places in Seattle where overdoses and crime are concentrated. An evidence-based approach. puke, evidence-based approach, like my you-know-what. So this, again, is from the Seattle Auditor's Office, where they go in and they actually have, like, they did some kind of monitoring of certain hotspots in the city of Seattle, and they created this 65-page report saying, here are some recommendations for the city of Seattle to make things better. First of all, this is full of the kind of crap that you'd expect it to be full of. You know, it's 65 pages. Did I read it all? No, I read a lot of it. And, you know, one of the first things I saw was this stupid graphic where it was like a strategic prevention framework. And it had, this is like government bureaucracy at its worst. It had this like 5-point diagram, and then around it, these arrows that said equity. And the second I see equity related to anything about how we deal with the drug crisis and people who are committing crimes and smoking hard drugs on our streets, I just wanna shut it off. But I can't, because I host a podcast where I'm supposed to explain these things to you guys. So unfortunately, I can't shut it off, and I have to read and look at all their stupid graphics that they create. So in this, they talked, you know, they brought up something that is true and that we all knew, which is these drug areas, right? They're pretty limited in terms of where they are. Like, there are areas of Seattle you can walk around and there's like no problems at all, but there are hotspots. And they said in particular, there are 10 continuous street segments that have the highest concentration of overdose responses and crime incidents. So some of those won't surprise you. Pike Street from 2nd to 5th, like right by Pike Place Market, 3rd Avenue, Union to Pine. Then you've got down by the courthouse, but they're all kind of in the same area, right? And they've identified them, and all we need are our eyeballs to identify them. You walk downtown and you know exactly where the hot pockets are for crime and substance abuse in these open-air markets. Like, it'll take, I was reading some review that was posted, our friend Ari Hoffman posted it, from someone who came in on one of the cruise ships, and they like left a review basically like of the cruise in Seattle and said, even this person who was their first time here said, avoid this area, this area, this area, otherwise you can walk around fine. Like, everyone knows what the problem areas are. But when you look at it like that, the fact that there's 10 areas specifically where most of this is happening, and most of it is being perpetrated by the same people over and over and over. And as a city, we can't get a handle on that. You know where it's happening. You know who's doing it. We have the laws on the books now that allow you to crack down on it. And you need a 65-page report from an auditor to tell you to do just that? And true to government bureaucracy, this was the key takeaway of, okay, what should the city of Seattle do, right? Like, besides, you know, I don't know, enforce the law, make sure there's consequences for actions, make sure we don't have a permissible environment for substance abuse, you know, like really obvious stuff. Their top recommendation was this. Lord help me. The mayor's office should identify a, quote, project champion to oversee the city's efforts to address places where overdoses and crimes are concentrated. We recommend that the mayor's office designate a high-level project champion to oversee a place-based problem-solving approach that includes implementing evidence-based strategies to address overdoses and crime, working with the Seattle Office of Emergency Management and other departments to use a proven coordination system, seeking technical assistance from and collaboration with... Like, the word soup of this for just enforce the law. And also, I'll tell you what, Seattle already has a project champion. Seattle already has one. Someone who is supposed to oversee the city's efforts to address overdoses and crime. You know who the project champion is? Do you want to take one guess, Nicole?
The mayor.
What?
Maybe.
The mayor. Did we not elect a project champion in the city of Seattle? We already got one. And in fact, our project champion, the mayor, he campaigned saying he was going to improve public safety. He was going to fight crime. He was going to fight addiction. So we really need another six-figure salaried position to do what the mayor should be doing in overseeing our city's response to fighting substance abuse and crime? Have you all gone mental? And on top of that, we need a 65-page report from the Seattle Auditor's Office to tell us that the mayor should be overseeing all of this? And to give us a little chart that says, oh, we can do all this, but equity, 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 equity. It's like enough to make me want to puke. And meantime, it's very serious because people die. People are dying on our streets, overdosing on our streets on a daily basis, what should be the economic engine for the entire state. looks like shit, looks like crap, sorry, looks terrible. And it has all these implications where now, as we've seen over the last 5 or so years in earnest, it's bled out into the other areas. So Seattle's problem has become Snohomish County's problem, has become Pierce County's problem. It's gone to the east and there's all these issues. So you're really telling me, I mean, God, I know it's easier to sit here in this chair and criticize public officials rather than run for office myself and do the hard work myself. I get it. I have self-awareness. I'm willing to admit that. A lot easier to be a podcast host and to criticize the mayor than to actually be the mayor and make these decisions. But if you didn't want to be the one to oversee the crime crisis, if you didn't want to be the one to oversee the drug overdoses and the issues that are happening in the most important, economically critically important part of the city, then why'd you even run? If you're not willing to be the person that says, that's not working, this is working, then why'd you even run? Are you just a figurehead? I guess I don't get it. I had a lot of hopes for Bruce Harrell. He said a lot of the right things, but it's a failure when the city auditor's office needs to come out, do a 65-page report about why we can't just enforce the laws and clean up our streets, and then suggest, well, I guess the mayor can't do it, so we need a project champion to do all these things. Not to mention, like, if the mayor wasn't your first pick for who the project champion is already, there is a second option, the police chief.
Right.
Like, yeah. Aren't there multiple layers of project champions already? And one of the other things that's wrapped up into this that was mentioned in the auditor's report are all these organizations that all your hard-earned money goes to, right? So they're supposed to provide housing and they're supposed to provide substance abuse treatment and all of these things that make the system work, because arresting people isn't the ticket out of this. I've said that all along. It's a last resort when the carrot and the stick, you know, the carrot doesn't work, so you got to hit them with a stick, figuratively, of course. Don't hit somebody with a stick unless they resist arrest, then by all means. So you have to have a holistic approach. But the issue is there's been, for years, this has been a problem. A homeless crisis to the drug, there's no tracking. It's like, here, take $50 million of our hard-earned money, and we won't follow up with you to see if you got any good outcomes out of that. We'll just keep funneling taxpayer funds toward you. So there's really no oversight of this massive industrial complex comprising of hundreds of millions of dollars. There's no oversight of it. So there's no benchmarks that people are having to meet to ensure that they deserve to continue to get our hard-earned money funneled to them. And what have I said all along? Whether it's the drug industrial complex, the homelessness industrial complex, the climate industrial complex, there is no incentive to stop the money train. So, like, they're going to keep, they don't, I mean, we're 10 years into this, right? It's been, I think, more than a decade since Dow Constantine said we were in a state of emergency around homelessness, or around a decade. Yet it's worse than it ever has been. It was up 20% year over year. Any rationally thinking person would say, okay, well, maybe this isn't working then and we have to change what we're doing. But the government's like, nah, we're getting so much money from the taxpayers and their generosity and we're funneling it to our cronies. So yeah, keep people living in the on the streets in filth and squalor, keep people dying with needles in their arms, like all that's fine, no big deal, because the money's still coming in. And for some reason, voters have not become wise to what's happening and they haven't voted us out yet. So why would we do anything any different? Anyway, yeah, 65-page audit to tell us you need someone to oversee the most critical issues the city is facing. Newsflash, Mayor Bruce Harrell, that's you. You are the, what is it called? Project champion.
I think it's funny that czar is now like a dirty word.
Oh, yeah. Can't call him the czar. We'll get to that later on in the show. Yeah. Like the street czar, Andre Taylor, the street czar.
Right, they have a bad rap.
Couldn't do that now. Mm-hmm. Can't call him a czar in an election year, at least. Just, it boggles the mind. And it's voters that are to blame. I'm sorry, you guys. You guys know. You're not voting for this. It just shocks me. It's like if you care at all about the homeless, you care at all about the people who are folded in half, high on fentanyl in downtown Seattle, why would you continue to vote for the same politicians, literally the same, because Dow Constantine, he's in his fourth term, who have maintained that status quo this entire time and taken a hell of a lot of money from you that you worked really hard for? Like, I don't even care if you vote for someone who's the same politically and just different, like a different person. I'd rather you do that. I mean, I think you should vote for something different politically so we actually have like a snowball's chance in hell of getting out of this crisis. But genuinely the exact same person, and then you let that person convince you that they're doing a good job? You guys, it's killing me inside a little bit. It's killing me. All right. So speaking of just an absolute train wreck of a situation and electing the same people who continue to take the state down the wrong path, let's talk about Bob Ferguson, shall we? Am I wrong, though, Nicole?
About what?
Am I, when I say
never,
that,
right? You're never wrong.
To be super annoyed that the Seattle Times editorial board would complain about the drug crisis downtown a week and a half after they endorsed Bob Ferguson, who is very proud of supporting the decriminalization of hard drugs. And now all of a sudden wants to walk away from that, like, oh, no, no.
Right.
It's like, no, you're on the record. So I can't take the ed board seriously anymore.
Oh, I mean, I couldn't take them seriously when they said, here, we're going to endorse Bob, but we don't like all of these things about him. This is all questionable, and we actually like this guy better, yep. But everybody else is going to go for Bob, so we're just going to go jump too. On that train.
It's so annoying. So I used to love the, oh, not love, that's, I used to respect the ed board because they would often break from the progressive narrative and stuff, but no, you don't get to complain about drug use when you're supporting the governor who wants to make all of that completely legal. You see? You see the issue
it's unreal.
That I have with that? It's so frustrating. Anyway, let's talk about Bob Ferguson's campaign for governor. I promise we will start a segment that said, what kind of BS did Bob spew today? Because really it is. I genuinely mean this. Covering politics for almost 15 years in this state, this is the most dishonest campaign I've ever witnessed. And it is a campaign more so than any other I've ever covered that's built on fear. Because Bob Ferguson is really hoping that if he can fearmonger voters on just a couple issues that he's not honest on, that he doesn't have to talk about his record, that he's not going to be forced to talk about the fact that in 2021 he wanted to legalize hard drugs, that he never spoke up in the summer of 2020 about the looting and the rioting and the crime, that he never spoke up on behalf of law enforcement, that he's wasted hundreds of millions of dollars in taxpayer funds on political prosecutions, etc. He knows that his actual record isn't good. So he's resorting to fear on two key issues, whether Dave Reichert supports Donald Trump and abortion. So I've told you guys before, I'm pro-choice. I am, that doesn't mean I'm going to go out and have abortions, by the way. I mean, people are like, oh, Brandy wants to kill babies. No, there's a difference between being pro-choice in the sense that I don't want the government in my business whenever possible. Of course, there have to be reasonable restrictions on anything medically, or else you're going to end up with a Dr. Kevorkian situation. So I'm not saying that there should be no restrictions. I support a woman's right to choose up to the point of fetal viability. But in the same sense that I was against vaccine mandates, like that's none of your business. It's up to well-regulated medical providers to help make those decisions with women. But yeah, I have no intention of getting an abortion, maybe not even getting pregnant. I don't know yet. Anyway, TMI. So Bob Ferguson is really honing in on this abortion thing with Dave Reichert, and he's been incredibly dishonest about it. Now, I'm not saying it's not an important issue to talk about. Yeah, I think Dave Reichert ought to answer for some votes that he took in Congress, and I think it's perfectly reasonable for him to be asked about his stance on abortion. Now, he has made clear time and time again, including on this show last week, that, yeah, he's a Christian man, so he is pro-life, but that doesn't mean that he has to be a Christian governor in the sense that he's going to push his personal religious beliefs on everyone else. And as he has stated, abortion was approved by voters, our current abortion law, in the 1970s in Washington. And he has no intent on overturning the will of voters, nor could he if he even wanted to. And that's the key. Dave Reichert cannot mess with our abortion rights as they are in Washington. He can't. He is not able to do it on an island. So any suggestion from the Bob Ferguson campaign that he can is just not true. Now, if people want to vote against Dave Reichert because they don't like that as a Christian, he's pro-life, and they just don't like his personal position and it's out of step with their personal position, then that's a different thing. But if they're voting against Dave Reichert because they've been led to believe that he could actually erode abortion rights in Washington, that's deceit. And they're voting based on a lie. And that's the difference that I want to draw is like, if you want to vote for Bob Ferguson based on facts about Dave Reichert and based on facts about Bob Ferguson and based on their actual records, like by all means, I would never knock you for wanting to do that. You do you. But to see people being tricked into voting for someone or tricked into voting against someone bothers me. Call me crazy, but that bothers me. I want you to cast your votes based on honest information. So anyway, Bob Ferguson's latest attack on Dave Reichert, he tweeted this out. Anti-choice Congressman Dave Reichert owes Washingtonians an explanation for why he voted with Donald Trump to gut Washington's voter-approved abortion protections and impose a nationwide abortion ban. Why would anyone believe what he's saying now? So there's obviously some fundamental issues with just that statement, and I'll address them momentarily, but he included a screenshot of a 2017 article from the Washington Post. The headline is this: "With Trump's backing, House approves ban on abortion after 20 weeks of pregnancy." So that's what Bob Ferguson is saying. Hey, Dave Reichert sided with Republicans in voting to in the House when he was in Congress to ban abortion after 20 weeks of pregnancy. And he wants to gut, that means he would want to gut Washington's voter-approved abortion protections. Now, a little bit, if you're not familiar with that vote that happened in 2017. So it was mostly along party lines. Dave Reichert did vote for this. It would have banned abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancy, with exceptions where the life of the mother is at risk, or rape and incest, so the big three exceptions. So you might look at that and say, oh my gosh, Dave Reichert wants to ban abortions after 20 weeks, and he voted to do that in Congress, except in cases where the life of the mother is at risk or rape and incest? And Bob Ferguson is suggesting that's extreme? That's almost exactly what Washington State's law on abortion is. That's almost exactly what our restrictions on abortion in Washington state already are. So in Washington state, there isn't a set number of weeks, but if you look at RCW, it states that Washington as a state, they may not deny or interfere with a pregnant individual's right to choose to have an abortion prior to viability of the fetus or to protect the pregnant individual's life or health. So prior to viability of the fetus is the standard in Washington state. Now, generally accepted medical wisdom is that a fetus becomes viable around 21 to 24 weeks. So at any point after that, and for all intents and purposes, Washington bans abortions after about 24 weeks, except in cases where the life of the mother is at risk. So the vote that Republicans took in Congress would have been to set essentially the same standard that Washington state has for the rest of the nation. So why does Bob Ferguson now think that that's extreme? What they were saying, and I don't agree with it. I like the state-by-state approach that has come after the repeal of Roe, because then you can really decide if abortion is your issue, it's a make or break. You can move to a state that more aligns with you ideologically. So I like it being in the hands of the states. I don't want Congress to pass any sort of nationwide restrictions. But Bob Ferguson can't call it extreme to ban abortions after the point of fetal viability when Washington state's law, which I believe fully supports, bans abortions after the point of fetal viability. So if he's saying what Dave Reichert did in Congress was extreme, then he's calling his own position on abortion extreme. He's calling Washington state's abortion law extreme, right? So that just shows you how it makes absolutely no sense in the world. Now, when it comes to my pro-choice position, I actually would like to see Washington states clarify just a little bit more, because when you're talking about up to the point of fetal viability, there is, I would say, maybe a 6 to 7 week window where doctors might disagree on what fetal viability actually means and what the percentage of the survival rate actually is in those areas and whether you would consider that viable. And so I would like to see it not left open to the interpretation of individual doctors. I think there ought to be a little more clarity to the law, but I would never push to see it changed. But again, what they did in 2017 is no more extreme or allowing than Washington state's law. So I'm not quite sure how Bob Ferguson could go after Dave Reichert for the very position on abortion that he holds. Odd, isn't it? All right, let's see. Coming up next, we're going to get into some juvenile crime issues that we've been talking about. We'll be joined by a senior deputy King County prosecuting attorney. First, if you're in the market to sell your home, I highly suggest reaching out to our friend Wes Jones at sellwithwes.com, sellwithwes.com. Wes has been doing this in this market for a really long time, and he says that although the interest rates haven't been great, now is actually a really good time for home sellers.
King County, median $1 million. Homes are still selling very, very quickly. If you want to do something this year, give me a call. I'd love to start the process now. I think that things will be moving very swiftly through probably October. And then as the election starts to come up, you know, get closer, people always pump the brakes. But for all of you who are out there that are thinking like, oh, you know, I can't sell my home because I need X amount, you're probably at the peak right now. You know, it's probably worth more than it's ever been than previous times. So what are you waiting for?
Yeah, so a couple things you can do. When you go to sellwithwes.com and reach out to Wes Jones, he'll start by giving you a free market analysis, just so you can see how well your home is positioned, what you can expect to maybe get for it, depending on where you're selling it and the timing. And then you can always use their home value calculator to see how much your home is worth. It might be worth more than you think. Sellwithwes.com, a better way to sell your home. All right, we're going to continue our focus on juvenile crime. It is at crisis levels. And really the difference that we've seen here is there are some areas of juvenile crime that are down, but the areas that are up are the most serious areas. You know, we've seen a lot of shootings involving juveniles. And when you've got juvenile suspects, oftentimes you also have juvenile victims. And yes, we have a lot of gang activity in Seattle that's contributing to those numbers as well. So a few things we want to cover today, just as a follow-up. Last week on the show, we talked about what's happening in the state's two juvenile detention facilities, how DCYF came out and they said, we're not booking anyone else into these things. Now, I don't know that they have the legal authority to do that, and there's some interesting court stuff happening in court on this right now. But there was a story done by Fox 13 where they profiled an inmate at Green Hill, which is one of the juvenile detention facilities, Kaya Lene, who's a murderer, like murdered a woman during a home invasion robbery, shot two people, the woman died. It was someone's mom, completely innocent. And now he's whining on the news that he, because of overcrowding issues in these juvenile detention facilities, he has to get moved into an adult facility. He's since been sent back as a court ruling thing. But he's over there whining like, this isn't fair. I feel betrayed that, like, as a murderer who's 22, who is an adult, to make room for younger inmates, I've got to move to an adult facility. So anyway, on Sundays with Subscribers, we had on State Representative Travis Couture, a Republican from Allen, who just toured Green Hill School and actually met this very inmate and got a firsthand look at some of the challenges with our juvenile detention facility. Here's a clip.
It was clear to me that he was kind of, you know, somewhat of a poster child for DCYF because he took on to all the programs. And we want them to do that. We want to rehabilitate people. But at the same time, these are adults, oftentimes, you know, in their early to mid-20s, who are in the same areas, you know, in the same Green Hill school with 13, 14-year-olds. And so a lot of people already kind of have a little bit of an issue with that. And of course, there's brain development science, but that doesn't mean your brain is not developed at all, right? And so it kind of disgusts me a little bit. It tells me that you haven't really learned anything if you think you've been betrayed because you have to complete your sentence for murder.
Hey, man. I mean, that was just such a good point. If you want to watch that full interview with Travis Couture, you can check it out on yesterday's episode of Sundays with Subscribers by signing up undividedpod.com. So you have this failure on the back end. And I think Travis made a very good point. You're saying that this kid is like fully reformed. He got his degree behind bars. He's writing books behind bars. Yet he feels betrayed. He has to go into an adult prison for just a couple years to serve the last remaining years of a very short sentence for homicide. One of the first steps to like admitting you have a problem or to solving whatever you're dealing with is admitting you have a problem, right? For anything. And if you feel betrayed by that, that shows me that that teen is not, or that young adult now is not rehabilitated at all. But anyway, as I was saying, a lot of these, what's happening with juveniles is very serious. And it obviously has a gang nexus, although politicians will say it's a gun nexus. And oh my gosh, if we could only take the guns off the streets, then whoop, magically this would be solved. But you've got this breakdown on the back end where you've got people like this inmate who think that they've been like taught that, oh, I can't, there's no consequences for murder. I have to go serve 2 years in adult prison. How horrible is that? But that's been instilled in these young criminals because they just get slaps on the wrist for things. And you've got activist judges who are cutting them loose for very serious crimes. So just over the weekend, this from our friend Ari Hoffman at Post Millennial. This is horrifying. This is horrifying. The headline, Seattle judge releases teen charged with bringing automatic weapons to a crowded parade. So it says, on Thursday, three young teens were arrested for bringing loaded guns modified to be fully automatic to a crowded Seattle parade. They pled not guilty in court. Despite the charges, a judge released one of the suspects to electronic home monitoring. They brought a gun modified, a loaded gun, fully auto, to a crowded parade, and he gets to be home on electronic home monitoring. It says one of the juveniles, 14, had a semi-automatic handgun. Another 14-year-old had a modified handgun with a 30-round magazine. Oh, I thought those were banned. How did he get that? That's crazy. And an auto sear, which allows for automatic firing. A 13-year-old juvenile had an untraceable polymer 80 handgun that was also equipped with an auto sear. So it gets even worse, because there was someone in the parade who had noticed these boys and pointed them out to police for a very terrifying reason. It says, according to court records obtained by the Ari Hoffman Show on Talk Radio 570 KVI, the family of a murdered 16-year-old killed in Auburn on July 12th was marching in the parade in honor of their son when they saw the three suspects who they believe are connected to his murder. Imagine that. You're marching in a parade to honor the life of your 16-year-old who was just murdered a couple weeks ago, when you see three juveniles who you believe were involved in the murder. They said they feared for their safety and alerted police. This is from law enforcement. The father of the deceased boy saw the three teens. They were leaning up against a building and smiling at him and nodding to him to seemingly taunt the dad. A parking enforcement officer was notified, and one of the teens made a show of pulling his hoodie up from his waistband and reaching into his waistband to retrieve a handgun. So imagine that scenario. And like, just look at any other scenario if somebody had brought fully automatic handguns to a parade. Like, let's say let's say a lone white gunman brought a fully automatic gun to a parade crowded with people. Do you think that they'd be home on electronic home monitoring right now, regardless of age? No. In fact, I am sure that Governor Jay Inslee, especially if they had the 30-round mag, Bob Ferguson, everyone would have come out and said, we need more gun control. This is like the gun culture in America, and many lives were saved by arresting this young person. But have you heard anything from any elected leaders about three very young juveniles armed with an awful lot of ammunition and obviously illegal guns? No, there's a clear double standard here. And I'm not just saying it has to do with race, but I think there's this real unwillingness to acknowledge the gang nexus to a lot of these juvenile crimes and to call it what it is, a gang violence problem. It's not a gun problem. And the longer that we call it a gun problem, the longer it's going to go unaddressed. And then also the lack of accountability. You're saying for this young, and it is a young teen, what they've just been shown is that they can bring a fully automatic weapon to a parade, presumably to threaten the family of someone who allegedly they were just involved in the murder of, and he gets to immediately go home on electronic home monitoring, and we expect that the juvenile crime crisis is going to get better. You see the problem here? Like, I just don't get it. I don't understand the disconnect between we take gun crime seriously, we must institute gun control, ban high-capacity magazines, ban so-called weapons of war. Then, like, a 14-year-old's got some, and you're like, no big deal. We won't even talk about it. And you expect the juvenile crime crisis to get better. Absolutely insane. So we have a guest on the show today that's going to talk to us a little bit about something we've been discussing on the show regularly, how to prevent juvenile crime. And one of the big issues there is making sure that there are positive things in these young people's lives from an early age, that they're committed to school, that they're attending school, that they have extracurricular activities, that they're being given the message that you can have a good life. You can achieve things regardless of the color of your skin. The system isn't here to hold you down. We're here to lift you up, and we're going to make sure that you stay connected to healthy endeavors. This segment is brought to you in partnership with our friends over at Future 42. Turn your frustration into action at Future 42. 2.org. So the new King County prosecutor, Lisa Mannion, she launched a program. And it's still at its infancy, I will say. So I think time is going to tell whether this program is successful. But it's called the Safer Schools Strategy, where it involves sort of having a closer working relationship at some of the schools where there have been instances of violence, where there have been students who have been involved in violence outside of school, making sure that there's a closer working relationship between the prosecutor's office and those schools to try to keep schools safer, to make sure schools are a safe environment, which we all want, right? But also to try to make sure that these kids stay on track. And how do we do that? And how do we prevent them from getting to the point where they're serving hard time? So we're joined today by Jamie Kvistad. She is a senior deputy prosecuting attorney with King County, who is one of the leads on the Safer School Strategy. Jamie, good morning. Welcome to Undivided.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So detail, before we even get into what your role is and everything that's going on with trying to make sure our schools are a safe place to be, as I think is uncontroversial, what are some of the challenges from a public safety perspective that we're seeing in our schools right now?
One of the big challenges I think we've seen is sort of chronic absenteeism, non-attendance. Children are required, or schools are dropped after 20 absences from enrollment at school. So oftentimes then these children don't come to school, they're behind, it's hard to locate them, to talk to their families, to assist with re-enrollment. So we really don't want to get into a situation where children aren't attending. We want them to be attending regularly. We want them to feel safe to attend school, and we want it to be a place that they want to be, where they can flourish and sort of attend and get, you know, the educational and protective factors that they receive at school.
Yeah, I guess how does that, what is the nexus there to public safety, you know, the chronic absenteeism versus the public safety issue?
Well, school is a huge protective factor for children. So when we look at risk factors and we look at protective factors, we know that poor academic performance is a predictor for juvenile delinquency. We know that schools that are poorly organized or poorly run, children, again, are more likely to face risk factors, engage with antisocial peer groups. So again, we really want to bolster our schools. We want to resource them. We want them to be a place that offer lots of extracurricular, lots of support. Children access mental health at schools. That's another huge nexus point where children can achieve mental health. And so again, we know that if our children aren't at school, we know where they are, right? They're not out on the streets during the day connecting with other children who aren't in school. We know that there are adults there that are responsible for them. And we know that their behaviors are being addressed and corrected. Schools are a huge place where children learn to socialize, right? Their social development is fostered and antisocial tendencies are corrected.
Yeah, I mean, we said this on the show last week. If the kid is in school, I know that they're not out getting into any trouble or something. So keeping them in school, keeping them in extracurricular activities, I think you're spot on. That's where we'd rather have kids. So what's the role of the prosecutor's office in all of this?
You know, we really looked sort of at coming out of COVID, some of the challenges that our schools are facing, and we developed this year our Safer School Strategy, which is really a multi-level approach to school safety. So at an individual level, I'm assigned to all of the school safety cases. And that may be as simple as, you know, a child who brings, say, a knife to school versus a child who brings a gun to school versus a serious robbery that occurs at school. And the reason we do that is that I'm then able to talk to the school. I'm able to assist the school with information for threat assessment, for safety planning. I'm able to work with law enforcement on warrants. At more of a district level, we assist with safety forums. We assist with more district-wide threat assessment. One of the things that we've done this year, which is different than what other counties are doing, is that the statute requires notification to schools when a child is convicted of a crime. But we now, when we have a child who is charged with a felony involving a firearm, we are sending the school notification. So we are sending them a copy of the charging document with a summary of the charges so they know the factual circumstances. We are sending them copies of conditions of release. Let's say that child, you know, was released from detention and is out on electronic home monitoring or out on their own personal recognizance. We want the school to know exactly what the conditions are so that, again, we can make sure they're being reinforced at home, at school. And then we're connecting with a juvenile probation counselor or really any other supportive, you know, adults in that child's life. If it's a mentorship program, Anyone else who can help us kind of hold that kid responsible, connect with all of the, you know, people involved in that kid's life and share information. So that's something that we started doing. I think we've sent out about 70 of those notifications so far this year. Again, really just trying to sort of foster accountability.
I mean, I got to say, I love all that. I mean, that makes sense, right? It's like, okay, if you've got a kid who committed allegedly a crime with a gun, the school should know about that, especially if they've got friends still at school and social groups, et cetera. I guess I'm curious how you got school districts to buy into that, because we know that there has been some pushback to any sort of law enforcement presence in schools. You know, school resource officers were very controversial, particularly around 2020, 2021. Aren't you a law enforcement presence?
You know, we have a lot of different school districts in King County, and so each district is really composed differently. I have found, though, that all of the districts are very much in agreement about wanting to keep kids safe, right? So it's like a child's not going to attend school if they don't feel safe at school. This law, the law also requires districts to engage in threat assessment. They're required to engage in safety planning. And one of the things that we often see after a tragedy occurs at school is kind of these information silos, right? When people had information, they didn't share that information. And so for us, it's really been about showing up at those meetings, working with the schools, letting them know that we, you know, we are not asking them to single out kids. We don't want kids excluded. We don't want kids kicked out of school. That's the worst outcome for me, right? When a child is, you know, suspended or expelled from school for the rest of the school year. No one's got eyes on that kid. We want the school to have this information so that they can determine, you know, what the risk level, what the need level is of this child, and that they can really wrap around this kid and support them in school, you know, re-engage them in school. And so I think they've definitely seen that commitment from us. Again, it's really just been about kind of connecting everyone, working with all of the different partners, working with community, working with law enforcement. I really think that that's, you know, the way forward, considering, I think, all of the challenges that our kids are facing right now. I mean, we're kind of in a unique world, right? We have cell phones, we have social media, we have huge exposure to screens, which we know is challenging for memory, right? It's challenging for learning. And so, you know, I think we ask a lot of our schools, right? We ask them to teach our, you know, keep our kids healthy, educate our children, watch our children while we're at work, right? Provide them, you know, flash education, provide them music, art, sports, like, you know, everything, right? And no one entity can do that alone for a child. I mean, that is about the parents. That's about the volunteers. That's about the community. And for us, it's about also the prosecutor's office, you know, doing our part to make sure that school is safe and feels supported.
Yeah, the Seattle Times last week, we talked about this on the show. They did a story about the spike in juvenile crime. And, you know, we're not talking about just, you know, delinquency or, you know, maybe stealing something from a grocery store. We're talking about like some serious, as you know, in the prosecutor's office, some serious, horrible juvenile crime. And usually the victims are juveniles as well. And one thing the Seattle Times pointed out is that the pandemic and kids being out of school really exacerbated that issue for the reasons you addressed earlier. It's like they're not in classes. So where are they and what are they doing? Have you guys found in doing this work that it has been hard to get some of these kids back in the fold after the pandemic and all that time away from school?
Well, absolutely. I mean, it is really challenging for our children who are very credit deficient and are, you know, going to be looking at being a 20-year-old senior, right? That path may not make sense forward. But the good thing is that we have a lot of other community organizations like Reconnect Opportunity, that offer GEDs, they offer credit retrieval, they offer many other paths forward for our kids. So again, you know, there's not a one, you know, one road for every child. And we recognize that. We really want to find what's appropriate for each child so that they can be engaged. I mean, one of the key sort of facets of behavior modification is that, you know, external motivation, say like the court system or the justice system, breeds internal motivation, right? So you do something for a while because you're forced to, right? You have to. But then, you know, you buy in and you realize you're doing it also because it's good for you and it helps you. And so then you have that internal motivation. So, I mean, that's the outcome that we really want. That's the outcome that we are looking forward to fostering. When it comes to juvenile crime, our numbers are low compared to 2019. They are higher, though, for violent crime, which, you know, we readily acknowledge. It's one of the reasons we launched our Safer School strategy. We are also working a lot more closely with law enforcement. We have another program we call JWatch, which is basically sort of like a Teams meeting that's available every week for our law enforcement to just jump into. It's a standing meeting. It's staffed by my chief, by my assistant chief, and we are there to offer questions. We offer trainings. We work on case development because we recognize these are really complex, serious crimes that are being committed by our juveniles. And, you know, we're very concerned.
Yeah. And how much of that is gang? Is there a gang nexus?
You know, I couldn't say specifically as to the numbers. I could say that our Class A felonies are definitely, I think, double what they were in 2019. But specifically, gang statistics, I couldn't tell you.
There's something that we always discuss, which is about early consequences, right? Because I think we can all agree that I would much rather have like a kid disciplined at school than get to the point where you are filing charges against them for a serious violent felony crime. Like, right, we don't want your office involved in juveniles because we don't want juveniles committing crime. So there's this aspect of, okay, how do we prevent them from getting to that point and potentially derailing the rest of their lives? So have you seen in working with the schools any sort of failure in the effort to hold kids accountable early on for things like delinquency and other issues that might be indicators or early indicators of that they're going down the wrong path?
Well, I think it's always challenging to hold, you know, to quote unquote, hold a juvenile accountable, right? Because we know that children are sort of the product of many different systems, right? They're the product of their home life. They're the product of, you know, their neighborhood. They're the product of the resources that their family have, of the challenges of the systems that they interact with that may or may not have served them well. So, you know, when we talk about changing kids' behavior, you know, we have much better outcomes when we work with families, right? So a lot of our treatment systems, you know, family functional therapy, multi-systemic therapy, there are systems that, or there are treatment modalities that are going to work with the family. And we also kind of want to support that family. So we don't want to just, you know, we can't, again, children need the support of their parents. They need the support of their home. They need the support of their school. So if we're going to work with kids, we really need to take a multifaceted approach. I mean, I think children with are 50% more likely to develop depression if their parents do. They're 30% more likely to develop anxiety if their parents have anxiety. So again, I mean, I think it's, yes, it's about holding a kid accountable, but it's also sort of like looking at the root problem of what's going on, right? And addressing it as holistically, and you're right, as expediently as we can. I mean, we never want to address behavior six months after it happened.
Yeah, I think, and just to give you some examples, you know, we went through during the pandemic, you know, that something I think has stuck, like, you know, you can't fail a kid that shows up. So this effort to sort of be more lenient when it comes to grading and disciplinary actions at school and making sure those disciplinary actions are equitable and all of that. And one of my concerns with that has been, okay, if you're teaching these kids early on that like there is no expectation for them, right? There's no bar to meet. I worry that that's will sort of put in their brain that I can get away with things. And we're seeing this at the criminal justice level as well. You know, I can't tell you how many times we've talked to the prosecutor's office because, you know, there's a juvenile who's been charged or is in court for a first appearance on a violent crime. And the prosecutor's office wants them held on $250,000 bail and a judge cuts them loose. There was just an example this weekend of a juvenile who brought an assault style rifle to a parade and they're already out of jail. They didn't get any, there was no bail set. So is that, I mean, from the prosecutor's office perspective, if you're trying to teach juveniles like there's consequences for their actions and teach their peers, like don't do that because this is the path you might go down, has there been a lack of consequence for juveniles in the criminal justice system?
Well, I think it's always hard to look at particular cases. And I think the case that you refer to, I think two of those children are still held in detention and one is on electronic home monitoring. I'll tell you the way unlawful possession of a firearm works for children in Washington is that crime is a felony. It's punishable by up to 30 days of detention. So as you can imagine, that's not a long time. No. And you have to have four of those convictions before you're even looking at a JR commitment. And I know you've referenced on your show before the situation at JR, right? And the challenges there. So yes, I mean, I think there are issues in the system that maybe need to be addressed. I do think that the juvenile justice system in King County in particular works to hold kids accountable. Oftentimes, detention is sort of an interrupter, right? It's an interrupter in behavior, kind of a chance to take a kid out of their environment, right? And then address what's going on. Again, is this kid in school? If this kid isn't in school, why? What's going on at home? Is this kid supported at home? Are there behavioral health issues that need to be addressed? So there's a lot of, sort of challenges that we work with. But again, our kids are ultimately always going to return to our community. So our best bet, right, is to support them in our community. I mean, that is our best chance to achieve sort of a long-term change in their behavior. But yes, we have to use the juvenile justice system appropriately when we can.
Yeah, and I'll give the King County Prosecutor's Office credit. I think there were some people concerned when your boss, Lisa Mannion, came in that there would be sort of a more soft on prosecution approach. I don't think that's been the case. And I think people tend to lump the whole criminal justice system together when it comes to where the failure is. But I guess what we've seen is people are being charged with crimes, and it's the breakdowns happening, in front of a judge, or it's happening in the sentencing phase, or it's happening at the juvenile justice phase. And like, everyone has to be firing on all cylinders to make sure that the justice system is working. So I guess the takeaway here for people who are worried about the juvenile crime crisis and what you guys are doing in trying to intervene early on at schools, what is going to be the barometer of whether this is a successful program?
I mean, we are going to keep developing our safer schools strategy. I mean, we at the juvenile division are serious about safety. I mean, we are working with law enforcement. We are working with our schools. We're going to continue to develop new strategies to do so. But really, this is also sort of about our communities, about our families, about all of our partners working together. I mean, juvenile crime is not a problem for the justice system, right? It's sort of a problem for all of us, a problem for public health, right? It's a problem for schools, it's a problem for families. So we are going to have to look at ways to sort of develop protective factors like schools, resource them, volunteer at them, right? Make sure our kids are engaged and make sure our children like really have a path forward. I mean, I think of the challenges that our children face now, like with things like artificial intelligence, right? Like, what does it mean to get a degree, right? What does it mean to graduate from high school? What is your path forward going to be? Are you excited about it? Are you invested in it? Is it something that you see and you are working towards? I mean, these are the things that we need to develop to motivate our children, right? To make them choose the things we want them to choose. So it's really something that we all have to kind of be committed to. We at the prosecutor's office are so far down the road, right? When we get most of these kids charged with violent crimes, you're right. I mean, we are digging ourselves out of a hole at that point. That's not the place to make our intervention. Our interventions should be as early as possible. They should be at the school level when it's appropriate. But again, I mean, we need to be supporting our schools, and we need to be engaged in working towards resourcing our kids as much as possible.
All right. Senior Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Jamie Kvistad, we appreciate your time and your work on this issue. And I agree with you on essentially all of that. Like, let's get kids in school. Let's get kids on a football field, taking out their aggression that way. And let's keep them the heck out of juvenile detention when at all possible. So thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Yeah, I found that interview insightful. I'm glad. So there's some things about this I like. There's some things about it I'm very skeptical about. But, having the prosecutor's office let a school know, hey, you have a student who was just charged with a felony gun crime. Like, yeah, glad they're doing that. We ought to be doing that. And you also look at, a friend group, and that helps the school figure out if they choose to utilize that information in the way they should be utilizing it, whether there are other kids who are at risk. Because if you've got a 14-year-old at a school who's involved in a gun crime, chances are they're involved in gangs. Well, who do they hang out at school? What do we know about those kids and what issues they're having? How do we do proactive outreach with parents or with support groups or coaches to get them involved in other things? Because we know that they're more susceptible to falling into the gang life, right? Like, this is common sense stuff. I don't like that you can't articulate the numbers on gang involvement. That seems like it would be pretty obvious. I tend to believe that the vast, vast majority of these young people who are using guns to commit crimes are gang members. Like, that just makes a lot of sense. I don't know a lot of other scenarios in which you have a young person like shooting at another young person. You have the one-off kind of instances of like school shootings or something like that, but those are really on an island and they're very, very rare. So usually there's a nexus to gang activity when you're talking about guns. And unless we're willing to be fully honest about that and call it what it is, again, you can't solve a problem that you refuse to properly identify. So let's call it what it is. We have a gang issue on our hands. But 100%, if we want early interventions, keep the kids in freaking schools, don't take them out for 2 years during the pandemic. We've already covered that. That had a lot of negative consequences. Get them on a football field, get them in extra. It doesn't even have to be an athletic program. Man, I was in speech and debate. Get them in speech and debate. And what do we always say? Message from the top down, whether it's politicians, the teachers, community members they trust, that you have a bright future ahead of you. Regardless of the color of your skin, your economic situation at home, you can be anything that you want to be in the United States of America. You just have to apply yourself and you have to find something that you're passionate about to put your energy into. That's the message we should be giving these kids. Not that society is going to hold them down and there's nothing they can do about it. All right, that segment is brought to you in partnership with our friends over at Future 42. Turn your frustration into action at future42.org. All right, today in our segment, unbelievable, is it offensive to call Vice President Kamala Harris a DEI hire? All right, so I've already said if we want to make, you know, Kamala Harris, I really believe is wholly unqualified to be the next president of the United States. I think she's shown that as the vice president. She really lacks knowledge on foreign issues, on domestic issues, all the way around. I think Republicans, if they want to be taken seriously, should be focused on her policy failures, not on like her cackling or whatever it is, although those things are kind of funny, or on her weird remarks about falling out of a coconut tree or whatever it is. But she has some serious policy failures. The country's not in a good place. She's not going to be any different than Joe Biden on policy issues. So let's focus on those things. But then there's the DEI aspect of it. So the Seattle Times, this is actually a headline from a column written by Danny Westneat. But the tweet they put out, calling a woman candidate the DEI hire, as the Washington State Republican Party did, isn't just bad form. It's bad politics and may boomerang on local Republicans, writes columnist Danny Westneat. So it was funny because I was looking at just the wording of that tweet, that it's bad form to call a woman candidate the DEI hire, to which myself and others on social media promptly pointed out that even the White House calls her a DEI hire. This is like we took it off the White House website from, it was a statement from Joe Biden. To me, the values of diversity, equity, inclusion are literally, and this is not kidding, the core strengths of America. That's why I'm proud to have the most diverse administration in history that taps into the full talents of our country. And it starts at the top with the vice president. So he's literally saying diversity, equity, inclusion are core values for us. And it starts at the top with the vice president. And not to mention that, like, he said he was going to hire a black woman. So you already reduced the field to like a small percentage based on immutable characteristics. So you made her the DEI hire. Now, if you hire, you're looking for the most meritocracy, the most qualified person for the job, and they just happen to be a woman or a person of color, that's not DEI. But if you lead with DEI, as Joe Biden did, saying it's going to be a woman, and not just a woman, but a black woman, then you've led with DEI. You've made it about DEI. Republicans haven't made it about DEI. That's just weird. So the question is that offensive? Is it offensive to call Kamala Harris the DEI candidate? I mean, if it's offensive, then you're saying that Joe Biden was offensive because, again, he said that she was the DEI candidate. But let's just have this discussion. So the actual content of Danny Westneat's article kind of goes a little further than, oh, it's offensive to call her the DEI candidate, because I'm not even sure that's the point he's making. I think I lost it a few places within it, and I tried to pick up back up what the point he was making was. But he's kind of suggesting that, like, yeah, you're saying that if you call her DEI, that she's not actually qualified for the job, but maybe being a DEI candidate isn't such a bad thing. So it says, he starts, so politics is kind of like the book business. Women are the dominant customers. It was a poor choice then for local Republicans to greet the news of the likely Democratic nominee, a woman who is black and South Asian, by dismissing her as a DEI hire. Let's see here. So they quoted the WAGOP that they put out a statement saying, anti-meritocratic DEI is not building back better. It's setting us further back. The WA GOP said in a statement, calling Kamala Harris unqualified to lead. Danny Westneat goes on to say, needing to be reminded not to be racist or sexist kind of says it all. Still, the local GOP couldn't restrain itself. 2 days later, on Thursday, the local party straight up declared that Harris was a DEI hire who will, quote, say and do anything for power. They followed that up by claiming her background hadn't been vetted because, quote, Dems don't vet, they check off DEI boxes. And then they included a quote in here from Representative Marilyn Strickland, who is the first Black member of Congress from Washington State. She said, quote, so if you're not a man and if you're not white, are you automatically considered a DEI hire? It's ridiculous. If DEI is the only thing you can say about her, it's saying that your argument is weak. Danny Westneat goes on to say, there are plenty of other arguments against Harris, all of which are fair game. There's her record as a prosecutor and her work on the southern border issue, among others. They keep going back to the sexism or racism. Well, anyway, so a couple things. First of all, I go back to Marilyn Strickland saying, so if you're not a man and you're not white, are you automatically considered a DEI hire? Again, Biden made her a DEI hire. He very well could have not fallen into the DEI trap of the left, where they insisted that he commit to hiring a Black woman. He could have had it in his mind, but he made sure he said that. And so then, yeah, automatically you're making a DEI hire. The same with Ketanji Brown Jackson, who I think it was offensive to say, I'm going to appoint a Black woman to the court, because it negated her accomplishments. I mean, she was and is well qualified to be a Supreme Court justice. I'm not making any sort of commentary on whether I think that she is making rulings that I agree with. I think the opposite is true, but that doesn't mean she's not qualified for the job. But when you start with DEI and then you go to choose someone, that's basically, I mean, to me, that undercuts whatever experience they might have. Because on the front end, you got rid of other people who might have been well experienced, so they didn't even get a go against like the actual best field of candidates to get the job. Those were just eliminated based on skin color or based on their sexual reproductive organs. So it's just strange. So I just, first of all, I just reject the narrative that, you know, Biden calls her a DEI hire. Diversity, equity, inclusion is the reason that he picked her, essentially. So you can't be mad at Republicans for pointing that out. You just can't. I don't understand that. And I do agree, though, with Danny Westneat saying there are other arguments against Harris that are more fair and more effective. 100%. Border, crime, she wanted to defund police, she wanted to defund ICE, the economy, all of those things, energy independence. So yeah, I go after those because those will stick more. And when you make the DEI argument, I think fewer people listen. But that doesn't mean that the DEI argument isn't valid. She's absolutely the DEI candidate. I asked you guys on social media whether you think it's an insult. Do you think it's an insult to call someone a DEI hire? Let's see here. 69% on Patreon are saying, yes, Brandy, I think that is an insult. 31% saying no. Denise says, this is a very conflicting question, since in some cases it very well may have been hired just for a quota, yet there may be people totally qualified that deserve that position, which is kind of the argument I'm making, is like, I think there are a lot of women, people of color, who are the best for the job. But when you lead with that, you're undermining their own credibility. You're undermining their credibility before they have a chance to prove that they're the best person for the job. Megan said, it's not an insult if true. The tricky part is now you might be accused of being a DEI hire based on gender, race, or sexual orientation, even when not true, which diminishes your accomplishments. Damned if you are, damned if you aren't. I mean, on paper, is Kamala Harris qualified to be the president? I suppose. I think our country has gotten kind of fast and loose with like what the qualifications are for president. I mean, Trump was never in politics. So that kind of negates the whole, you have to serve certain things in the political realm to be qualified. Qualifications for presidents that we actually elect are all over the place. Kamala Harris was a first term senator when she was chosen to be vice president. J.D. Vance was a first term senator and he was chosen to run with Trump as vice president. So it's kind of weird. They're very fast and loose with what does it mean to be qualified? Will Culbertson, is it an insult? Sure. It's true, just like a nepotism hire. Someone that did it on their own merits, though, isn't one. And so it's, sorry that I got confused with that comment. Karen, it's not an insult when it speaks truth, when we know a hire is due to DEI, as in the case of our VP. DEI is an insult to people hired due to their skill set. The existence of DEI muddies the waters, causing questions to arise as to why individuals are hired. I would want to know I was hired because of merit, not because I'm a woman. And that's the whole point. I think there's some agreement there. It's like, when you make it about DEI, then you're signaling that they might not have been selected otherwise. So I agree. To me, it's an insult, because if you're a Black woman who is absolutely qualified for a job, but on the front end, it's been made clear that you're being selected because, in part, the color of your skin and your gender, then it totally undercuts you as a candidate, as a person, as a professional. So I do see it as an insult. But Democrats have said it's a great thing. DEI is awesome. We lead with DEI. It's core to what we do. So then you can't turn around and call DEI hires insulting. I don't get where you're coming from there. It's really unbelievable. Okay, let's see here. I've been encouraging you guys to take the First Mark challenge, firstmarkinsurance.com. Why? Because you say it could save money. It costs you nothing. You could end up with better insurance for a lower price. Don't all those things sound good, especially when so many families are trying to take a closer look at their budget? So the First Mark Challenge, I took it, gosh, it's been a couple of years now, and Mike and I just love being members of the First Mark family. We ended up getting better insurance for the same price. What they're going to do is review all your current insurance, talk about your insurance needs, and they're going to go out, they're going to shop the market for you and come back with their recommendations. Maggie, a fan of Undivided, told us that she finally decided to do the First Mark Challenge after she had to resign from work due to an unexpected situation. She said, I'm happy to report I was connected with Levi at First Mark, and after he reviewed my car and home insurance, he recommended a new bundle that was half the cost and better coverage. Casey says they saved him 37% off their family's auto quote for the same coverage. He said, every dollar counts. To join the First Mark family. So become a member of the growing First Mark family. Take the First Mark challenge today, firstmarkinsurance.com, firstmarkinsurance.com. The very best part is not only do they work for you, not the insurance companies, but you never pay First Mark a dime for their services. And I think that's pretty cool. All right, let's fit in some national news. So last week it was this whole, oh, Kamala Harris was never the border czar. They never appointed her the border czar. And Axios had this whole thing. Oh, GOP made up this title so they could pin the border situation on Kamala Harris. And then Axios had to correct itself because they called her the border czar in 2021. There's all these examples of like the media in unison trying to pretend like Kamala Harris was never put in charge of the southern border. And there's old clips of CNN calling her the border czar. And now they're saying, oh, Republicans gave her this fake title, the border czar. So just wild. So on Sundays with Subscribers yesterday, we had on the one person who I trust to tell us whether Kamala Harris was the border czar or not. And that is Allie Bradley, our friend who's a correspondent with News Nation covering the southern border.
Was Kamala Harris the border czar or not the border czar?
Okay, so the reality is this. She never actually was given the term border czar from the Biden administration. However, her role was to dig into the root causes of illegal immigration coming from the Northern Triangle. And what happens? It comes through Mexico. So she was in charge of those diplomatic relations and trying to stem the flow of illegal immigration and trying to get to the root causes. And so for the last 3.5 years, everybody, left, right, good, bad, indifferent, has called her the border czar. It's not until last week that it was a problem. It's not until last week that people started saying, wait, wait, wait. And obviously, we're going into one of the most contentious elections that we've ever been witness to. So it makes sense that they would start to go, hold on. What does border czar exactly mean? And what has she done? And we're going into election. So now we don't like that term right now. So that is what I'm seeing, because again, we have openly referred to her as border czar. I guess maybe the media made it up. I don't know. But when it comes to you're in charge of what's going on along our southern border by way of diplomatic relations and why they're leaving, I would say that's pretty much border czar.
Do you think there's even a way for her to convince the American people that she is up to the task of dealing with the situation at the southern border?
I think that's going to be really hard, right? Because titles aside, people do associate her as the person in the administration that was tapped to kind of oversee it in one way, shape, or form. It doesn't matter what the splitting hairs logistics of what role it was. America saw her as President Biden's right hand for border response. That's what it was. So to turn around and just say, well, she wasn't the border czar, I don't know if that's going to be enough to convince America that she had a pulse on the border, that she was working on diplomatic relations with these countries, you know, because they know what's happening. The diplomatic relation resulted in a 30,000 person a month parole program. That's what we're doing. The diplomatic relations, you know, produced two pop-up facilities down in the Northern Triangle so they could be processed down there and bypass the border. You know, that's what it led to. And I don't think the American people liked that. I think the American people felt like the kind of wool was kind of pulled over their eyes a little bit, because what's going on down there? We didn't know about that, right? So a lot of things, if we didn't have the handful of people covering the border that have been, a lot of things have happened that America would never know about. And so I think it's going to be tough to convince people that she cares about what's happening at the border. I think it's going to be tough to convince people that there's not going to be more of the same of what we saw for 3.5 years, because I also think people are wise enough to know that the Biden administration didn't fix the world migrant crisis, which they called it, with an executive action.
That's part of my conversation with Allie Bradley, News Nation correspondent covering the southern border. She joined us for Sundays with Subscribers. If you'd like to watch that full interview, man, she's a wealth of knowledge on what's happening down there. You can sign up. UndividedPod.com. UndividedPod.com. How hard is that? How hard is that to just use nuance? Like, was she ever given the title border czar? No. But everybody called her a border czar. On the left, on the right, indifferent. And now they're saying you can't do that without any self-reflection. Like, is it really just that hard to say, hey, we called her the border czar. Technically, that's not a title, but she was in charge of the southern border. Is that really too much to expect from our media? That's why we love Allie Bradley. She's great. All right, one quick international news right now, but it's just near and dear to our heart on an issue that bothers me to the core. So a court in Britain has upheld a ban on puberty blockers for juveniles there. And, you know, we continue to see overseas them really lead the way on walking back some of this extreme gender ideology. I think it's only a matter of time before that happens in the United States. So maybe this is an indicator of what's to come here. I certainly hope so. This is the headline from BBC. Puberty blocker ban is lawful, says High Court. And this, there was a obviously a court case going on, but there was an emergency ban put in place on prescribing puberty blockers. It was set to expire in September. Now the High Court in Britain says it is lawful to have a ban on this. And I think their only exception is if it's being used in studies, which for minors, and this doesn't have anything to do with adults, but if it's used in clinical trials, they can still do it. And if you're on puberty blockers already, you can continue to be on puberty blockers. So it would be involved in new prescriptions for juveniles that aren't part of clinical trials. Health Secretary Wes Streetling said he welcomed the court ruling, adding that children's health care must be, quote, evidence-led. Imagine that. Quote, we must therefore act cautiously and with care when it comes to this vulnerable group of young people. Mr. Streetling said he was working with NHS England to improve children's gender identity services and was setting up a clinical trial to establish the evidence on puberty blockers. Well, they're going to get started real fast on that clinical trial where they can use puberty blockers. He said, I want trans people in our country to feel safe, accepted, and be able to live with freedom and dignity. So anyway, that's I wanted to give you an update because we had talked about that initially. And so now that ban being deemed lawful, I think, is a really good start. And it's kind of sad that now they're like, well, now we'll do a clinical trial to study it. It's like, shouldn't all that happen before you are prescribing puberty blockers to kids? And that is true with much of the world, where they're like, oh, let's just do all these extreme gender ideology things to juveniles, and then we'll come back, and then, oh, maybe we should wind that back a little bit. Maybe we ought to study that. It's like, what other areas of health are you like, let's do that to a kid and study it later? It's just very strange. So Britain, good for you. Love it. All right, we're going to get to questions and comments coming up next, as well as our closing sanity check. Sorry, we're going a little late today. It's Monday, after all. We just have all those pent-up stuff to talk about from the weekend. First of all, if any of you attended the inflation webinar that Zach Abraham and his team at Bulwark Capital had on Thursday, let me know how it went. You know, when you look at your retirement and you're planning for a certain retirement, is your retirement portfolio going to be able to weather all the crazy economic situations? And I think you should ask yourself, how many times during recent events has your financial advisor not reacted to current events? Like something big happens and you're not hearing from them, they're not reacting, they're not adjusting things, not making changes to your investment portfolio. Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital and host of the Know Your Risk Radio podcast, talks about this all the time. He has his radio show, obviously, but this is their number one focus, is managing risk and making sure that as these world events happen, you've got a critical election, global unrest, that they are reacting to that. and that they are making changes to mitigate your risk in retirement. It's very important. Bulwark Capital is always looking for opportunities to lower risk, lower cost, give you as much upside as possible. You only get one retirement. That's exactly why you need Zach Abraham and Bulwark Capital in your corner. So let them show you how their risk management strategy can protect that retirement that you've worked so hard for. You can learn about Bulwark strategies with their free Common Sense Investing Guide. Get yours by calling 866-779-RISK or just go to knowyourriskradio.com. That's knowyourriskradio.com. Radio.com. Investment advisory services offered through Trek Financial LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. Investments involve risk and are not guaranteed. Past performance doesn't guarantee future results. Trek 24244. Go to knowyourriskradio.com. All right, questions, comments. Let's see here. On the drugs study, it was more of a audit. Thank you. It was an 65-page audit by the city of Seattle to figure out why they still have a drug crisis. Observer 777 says, and they paid money for a feasibility study on a cap for part of downtown. They want to cover part of downtown to create a public area. They do? Like a lid? Like an interstate lid? What do they want to put a cap on?
That was a thing to cover the, yeah. What a
terrible idea.
Right.
Because it'll just become a drug den.
I think it's been shot down.
Okay, but I hope so. Let's see. Matthew Cook says, we are the project champions, my friends, and we'll keep on deflecting till the end. That's a good song,
Matthew.
I thought
it'd just be funny to make you sing that.
Wow. You know, I love to sing. That's not making me do anything. D-Man in Seattle says, yes, of course. Every elected official needs 10 people who are highly paid to take the blame for any and all decisions made by their respective offices. Yep. On youth crime, Carlene Heath says, send anyone over 21 years old to the big house because we have way too many youngsters playing big games. I tend to agree. I already have told you guys where I think the juvenile detention cutoff ought to be. Let me see. Mary Christie, these 12 to 16-year-olds are brought up to Alderwood Mall by gang members from places like Tacoma, then set loose to carjack and rob people. They have guns in their waistbands. And the older gang members send the younger ones. Because this exact reason, we talk about it all the time, they're used as pawns because there won't be consequences to them, for them to the level there are for the older gang members. They just use the kid. There should be some law that says basically like, if it's done in consultation with another gang member or at the behest of another gang member,
right,
that you are responsible. Just like if you're present for a murder and you don't do anything, like you're culpable as well. So
I also think this is another, just like the drugs, I mean, it's spreading. It's moved to Alderwood Mall. I mean, I don't feel like that was a mall that we were scared to go to. And then, I mean, I just had a drive-by shooting right across the street from me. And I consider myself living in a decent area.
Yeah.
But there's been some crazy things going. And it was a 17-year-old that got shot. Like, it's been crazy. It is spreading. So that's Everett. So now we're keep going north. Keep going south. It's crazy.
Absolutely wild.
And, gotta get a handle.
Let's see here. Lynn Blevins, when the kids are arrested, is anyone looking at their family and stepping in to help make the family more accountable? I don't know. Mm-hmm. But like, who is holding them accountable to show up? And we did a story on this juvenile detention program where like they couldn't even locate half the kids that enrolled in the program because they just weren't accountable to anybody or anything, or the parents didn't care and didn't want to help them participate. So when you've got, like we talked on the show last week, when you've got a 7-year-old who is robbing teenage girls on a metro bus with a hatchet, if you're a parent, like, you know where your 7-year-old kid is, right? So it shows you how bad the parenting is if you don't know that your 7-year-old is out with a group of older kids robbing 15-year-old girls with a hatchet. There has to be some accountability there for parents.
And I think you used this example last week, the Enumclaw. We were told by their police chief, it was months ago now, but that they have this group of teens that keep offending and they take them back to the parents and parents get mad at the cops for busting them. The parents are against them being, you know, held accountable. So, I mean, what do you do?
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard because, I mentioned this with the prosecutor. I don't want the government unduly meddling in the household. But when your parenting is having a negative impact on society and is putting people at risk, that's different, right?
If your kid's caught with alcohol that you supplied them, then you are in trouble. So if they're caught with a gun that you supplied them or that you knew was in your house and didn't do anything about or whatever it is, it should be there should be something built into that, right? Yeah. Make sure it doesn't happen again.
Yeah. Weiss Castle on the is Kamala Harris a czar or not a czar? Czar is the title that's been used for 60 plus years when a person is given an important job that doesn't fit any current cabinet position. Yeah. All they're trying to do is just trying to diminish her role on the border because the border is a mess. It's so transparent. The sad thing is I expect Democrats to do that. But when the media, like across the board, is doing that, then the media is just a wing of the government at that point, and the media is not doing its job at all. All right, speaking of the media, which we love, of course, let's get to our closing sanity check. I saw this clip shared on X with just the funniest little blurb. It said, MSNBC will never get over this. And they shared a clip of a story on black voters that aired on MSNBC.
How many of you know a black man who has expressed to you that they're committed to voting for Donald Trump? Okay. For the brothers who have told you that or said that to you, has the emergence of Kamala Harris changed that for those brothers?
No.
I agree. MSNBC will never get over that. That has been your sanity check for today. That has been today's episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving Common Sense a comeback. We appreciate every single one of you. If you like the content that we bring you on the show every day, please make sure to subscribe to help support the show. It's just $5 a month. I think that's a screaming deal. UndividedPod.com, UndividedPod.com. While you're there, you can shop our merch store, the Sanity 2024 Collection. You get 25% off with the promo code SANITY24. Sanity and the number 24. We will see you back here on the live show tomorrow at noon. Farewell. Okay. Give me a minute.